son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States.
And it is in this spirit that today I announce my candidacy for president of the United States of America.
I'm ready to solve these problems. I'm running for president of the United States.
I stand before you as the first woman elected to the United States Senate from the state of Minnesota to announce my candidacy for president of the United States.
And that was, in order, South Bend, Indiana, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, U.S. Representative Tulsi Gabbard, U.S. Representative Eric Swalwell, and Senator Amy Klobuchar, all announcing their plans to run for president in 2020. So far, at least 18 Democrats have thrown their hat into the race. Most of them don't really have a chance of winning, but there's also almost no downside to running either. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But first, President Trump recently released his 2020 fundraising numbers. He's raised more than $30 million, about what the top two Democrats in the field have raised combined. Joining us to talk about the significance of that statistic is Teddy Schleifer. He covers money in politics and techs for Recode. And hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Great to have you here. And $30 million Trump dollars, that is an eye-popping number. How worried should Democrats be?
You know, I think that these are two very different races happening side by side. There's obviously a competitive Democratic primary with, upwards of two dozen people running. And obviously on the Republican side, there is one, maybe one and a half, depending how you count it, candidates running on that side. And Trump has also had 2 years, basically, to run as an incumbent. And it should not be news to Democrats that being the incumbent president of the United States has a lot of fundraising advantages, and Trump's taking advantage of it. I wouldn't be overly concerned at this point if you were Democrats. I do think that, you could argue that Democrats are raising less than they did during their last really competitive primary race. But comparing Democrats to Trump doesn't totally tell the whole story.
But what about the fact that a lot of those donations Trump got come from small givers? What does that say?
Yeah. I mean, Trump obviously has tapped into both ideologically, but also in terms of just from a pure kind of tactical standpoint, has tapped into what small dollar donors want to hear. And, you know, there was a ton of ink spilt 4 years ago over kind of whether Trump could be financially competitive given his kind of revulsion for big donors. You may remember he would frequently name these people in debates, right? Call out the donors in the audience. But Trump has shown he basically doesn't really need it. And he's got a pretty fervent base of supporters who will give 20, 30 bucks a pop.
Well, you just said, too, it's too early to say what the significance is. But there was a lot of conversation in 2016 about the fact that Hillary Clinton had far outraised and outspent Trump, and she lost.
Right.
So it really begs the question,
right,
you know, how much do the millions really matter?
Certainly. That's something that donors are sort of reckoning with privately as well. I mean, on the Democratic side, for instance, you know, the real way that big donors can make an impact is through super PACs. And those have basically been declared, personas non gratas in Democratic politics right now. So they can only give $2,800 per contribution, just like, you know, anybody else can who has that amount of money. So I think there's an argument to be made that, Trump certainly will be financially competitive this cycle. I think a lot of people in politics, the aphorism would be that money is necessary but not sufficient. And he's got the necessary money to compete.
And taking a closer look at the Democratic side, Senators Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, they're in the fundraising lead. What can you read in these financial tea leaves about how this race is heating up?
Sure. Well, I think there's, you know, with Bernie Sanders specifically, he's very clearly going to be the fundraising leader, at least, and for the early part of this campaign. You know, 84% of his money came from small dollar donors, which is generally seen as more sustainable, right? Because there's a maximum amount you can give. And if someone's given 50 bucks a pop, you know, you do well in a debate, you win an early caucus or primary, they'll give you $50 more and $50 more. So I think a key metric at this point in the race is how much of the money is coming from small givers, because that sort of speaks to the sustainability of what they're building. And Bernie clearly has that. You mentioned Kamala Harris as well. She is clearly the favorite of big givers, of kind of, you know, people in Hollywood, people in Silicon Valley, people who are millionaires and have lots of zeros in their bank account. They like Kamala Harris. But, you know, there are candidates who we've done even who are even more dependent on big donors. Someone like Kirsten Gillibrand, you know, I was really surprised looking at the fundraising reports that only about 15% of her money came from small dollar donors compared to 85% for Bernie Sanders. So kind of how it's raised tells you a lot about the campaign, just like the top line number does.
And there are also just a ton of people in the race on the Democratic side, 18 and counting so far. Is there in the timeline a tipping point when you really can find out how their respective campaigns are faring? Because we're so early on now.
Yeah, I mean, someone who's certainly thinking about that right now has got to be Joe Biden, who is obviously not raising money right now. He's not even a declared presidential candidate. And right now, he'd be looking, I'm sure his operatives are looking at these FEC reports and saying, you know, we're in a hole, right? The longer you wait, the longer you're in a hole. And, you know, I think presidential campaigns are not a battle to raise the most money, right? I mean, they're about a battle for votes, and money enables you to get votes. So Joe Biden is probably sitting there thinking, can I be competitive with Bernie Sanders, with Kamala Harris on a fundraising perspective? But ultimately, this is about winning people over, not just kind of trying to collect the biggest possible war chest as possible.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks so much, guys.
Teddy Schleifer covers money in politics and tech for Recode. We're now on the 18 Democratic presidential hopefuls. We hear a lot about Bernie Sanders and Kamala Harris, the top two fundraisers in the race for the Democratic nomination, as I just said, and other big-name candidates like Warren, Booker, Buttigieg, O'Rourke. But then there are candidates who barely register in most polls so far, like Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, former tech executive Andrew Yang, and California Congressman Eric Swalwell, who threw his hat in the ring last week. The odds are against these candidates by far. So why do people who most likely stand no chance run for president? Matt Flagenheimer wrote about this for The New York Times, joins me now, and it's good to have you on Press Play.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Well, just to get a fix on the odds for some of these candidates, let's talk about Eric Swalwell, the most recent one to announce. There's not even any polling data on him yet. What kind of chances, or how do you think about his chances as a virtual unknown in a race among 18 or 18 so far?
Sure. I'm not sure what the sort of Vegas odds makers would have to say at this point. Certainly, it's an uphill battle for somebody who is not widely known outside of his district. He has been somebody who's sort of ubiquitous on television as a member of the House, very outspoken against President Trump, has taken on gun control as sort of an organizing issue on this campaign. But certainly for somebody like him, the much likelier outcome is that this is something that makes him better known nationally, builds a wider base of donors, exposes him to different audiences. And then in the end, he is somebody who sort of loses with grace, as many of them would perhaps aspire to in a field of 18.
And looking at that field of 18, do they really differentiate themselves on the issues all that much to even help you figure out who might have a chance? Give us a sense of that.
I think at the top of the field, you have a sense in sort of broad strokes where a lot of the candidates are. You know, obviously Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have anchored their bids in a sort of economic argument about inequality and economic fairness. For somebody who is trying to sort of break through on the lower register, you know, in Swalwell's case, he's sort of seizing on gun control. Andrew Yang is somebody who has talked about a universal basic income and a sort of transformational concerns he has about automation in the workforce. There are people who have gotten behind the Tulsi Gabbard cause because of what she has to say about military intervention overseas. So there are certainly, in a lot of these cases, a single issue or a couple of issues that they hope to animate their base on, but certainly at the top of the field, there are folks who are expected to be very fluent across any number of issues in a primary.
Okay, so given these many contenders popping up, you did ask this question, you know, why go for it if you don't have a chance of winning? And to dig into that, you looked at how running for a presidential nomination and losing has affected people's careers in the past. And some examples of that are Reverend Al Sharpton and Mike Huckabee and Ben Carson. And all of those were super long shots. So how did those three fare after their unsuccessful bids?
Sure. I mean, I think there is certainly a case both in the more kind of altruistic sense of having a platform for an issue that's important to you And then in the sort of personal and occasionally, more than occasionally, financial sphere, it can be very helpful to run for president. Certainly, you know, Mike Huckabee and Ben Carson have sold books in the sort of aftermath of a presidential campaign. Ben Carson took a hiatus during his presidential campaign in 2015 before the primaries in 2016 to go on a book tour. And, you know, there is certainly the kind of traditional way that we think about losing candidates in a primary benefiting from having run, which is, you know, they end up in the cabinet. You know, Joe Biden was vice president after running in 2008. The less traditional course that we've seen more of in the last few cycles is that people really find a way to leverage that kind of national political celebrity into a post-campaign career in television, radio. There are certainly opportunities for that sort of thing.
You're making it sound like there are no downsides.
It depends on the circumstances. Certainly in 2016, if you were somebody like Jeb Bush, who came in as a person expected to do very well, the expectations were in a certain place. And given the way that President Trump campaigns and the kind of blistering personal attacks, I don't think anybody would argue that Jeb Bush came out of the campaign in a better place for future national runs than he went in 2015. But in a lot of cases, if you don't have a ton to lose electorally, besides an election you're not expected to win, the downsides are not that many.
Well, maybe I'm reaching too far here, but do you think that you can see, having looked at this, that more people think about running for president as a way to build your brand, that that's where we are in a snapshot?
It's hard to say. I mean, that is certainly the most cynical view of a lot of this. At the very least, it is an offshoot of having run, and people are very aware of that fact. You know, as Newt Gingrich put it to me the other day, it sort of gives you a certain stature for the rest of your life. He compared it to being Speaker of the House, that, you know, when you get introduced for a speech or a conference, they say, you know, and former presidential candidate. And there is some sort of gravitas attached to that that can open doors that weren't there before.
And do you see this as something new? I mean, you must, because you just wrote an article about it.
I think to some degree, I mean, the sort of incentives around cable news and the kind of intersection of politics and celebrity, we've certainly been kind of trending in this direction. And President Trump is somebody who obviously understood the sort of branding benefits of politics and is, you know, keenly aware of what his name meant to national audiences before he got into politics and what it has continued to mean since getting in. I think if you're coming in without the reputation and sort of name identification of somebody like Donald Trump, you know, there is no national television show called The Apprentice with Eric Swalwell. There is not the same sort of built-in audience for this sort of thing in a lot of cases, but that potential is there to really grow your brand politically, whether that means running for a future office, whether that means promoting a pet issue in a way that furthers the cause, whether that means getting on television down the line. All of those opportunities are there.
Okay, well, we'll have to have another conversation about what this does for democracy on another show. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks. Take care.
You too. Matt Flagenheimer covers national politics for The New York Times. Coming up, the U.S. is on track for a record-breaking measles epidemic this year, and we now know who started an outbreak in one state. The fascinating story of the traveling fundraiser who became Michigan's patient zero. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bocave. The U.S. is on pace to break the record for the most measles cases in a single year since the disease was eliminated 2 decades ago. Health officials are reporting 555 cases so far this year, and officials have identified a patient zero for one of the major outbreaks. Last November, a man flew from Israel to Brooklyn, which was in the midst of a measles epidemic. From there, he traveled to Michigan, visiting ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities, unknowingly bringing the virus with him. He stayed in private homes. He stopped by multiple synagogues and ultimately infected 39 people in the Detroit area. Well, here to talk about this and the nationwide outbreak is Lena Sun, health reporter for The Washington Post. And welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So could you first give us a big picture of measles nationwide right now?
Well, for the third week in a row, U.S. health officials have added dozens of new reports to the year's list of confirmed measles cases. They are in 20 states, but the 6 current outbreaks are in California, New Jersey, New York, and Washington states. And the biggest one is in the New York area, concentrated in New York City's ultra-Orthodox Jewish community.
And of course, one of the real issues with measles is just how infectious it is. So if an infected person walks through a room, how likely are you to contract measles if you're not vaccinated?
If you're not vaccinated and you are in that same room up to 2 hours after the infected person has walked through, you have a 90% chance of getting measles. Think about it. It is an exquisitely contagious disease.
And what's the Center for Disease Control telling people to do right now, given the speed of these cases, the rate?
I think they're urging everyone to get vaccinated, and especially if you're thinking about travel during spring break or summer vacation to go to Europe or many of these other places where there are major outbreaks, it's important to get vaccinated. Usually, children are vaccinated starting at 12 to 15 months. But they say that if you're going to be traveling, you can get the baby vaccinated as early as 6 months.
And now international travel, it's always a prime vector of measles, and that figures into this patient zero story, too, that we're about to talk about. Remind us why that is, that a lot of these outbreaks start with travelers visiting the United States or U.S. residents returning from abroad.
Because right now around the world, there are measles outbreaks in many, many parts of the world. The WHO has just come out with a report that says measles cases increased 300% worldwide in the first 3 months of 2019 compared to the first 3 months in 2018. Many countries in Europe, big parts of Africa, Southeast Asia, Japan, all have measles cases. Africa had the biggest rise in measles cases. And in Madagascar, for example, where infrastructure is a big challenge, 1,200 people have died from measles.
And that's because there are fewer people who are vaccinated abroad.
Right.
And it's, I understand, it's very easy to drop below the level of immunity if more and more people don't vaccinate.
Right. So because measles is so infectious, in order for a community to be protected, you need to have 96% of that community vaccinated or higher. So that's to protect against kids who are too little to be vaccinated or people who are immune compromised and can't get the vaccinations. That's something called herd immunity, but a better way to think about it is community immunity. And every disease is different, but measles requires a really, really high level. So you just have to slip below 90-something percent, and you lose that protection.
And let's talk now about Michigan's patient zero, and you've tracked this story. So this man flew to the United States from Israel, and he was raising money for charity in different Orthodox communities, starting in New York. Tell us what happened next.
He stayed in Brooklyn for about 2 months, and he was fundraising, and he, in early March, decided to travel to the Detroit area. He drove overnight through the night, and he was beginning to feel sick en route. And he saw a doctor when he arrived in the Detroit area. But the doctor, like many doctors these days, had never seen measles. He misdiagnosed the man's fever and cough as bronchitis and gave the man an antibiotic. And the next day, the man complained about having a rash and the doctor thought, oh, he's having an allergic reaction to the antibiotic, when in fact the man was having the measles telltale rash. So you are infectious with measles 4 days before the rash and 4 days afterward. And all that time when the man was in the Detroit area, he had been living in people's homes, going to synagogue sometimes 3 times a day, shopping in kosher markets, and in very close proximity to hundreds and hundreds of adults.
Is it relevant that this is all happening within an Orthodox community? How does that factor into patient zero's story?
I think what's important to remember is that many communities, whether Orthodox Jewish or faith Christian or Somali or Eastern European, when you live in proximity to one another and spend a lot of time interacting, working, and socializing, it doesn't really matter what your cultural heritage is or your ethnicity. It's the fact that you're all tightly together, and that is how disease travels. Measles doesn't care. They just want to infect as many people as possible.
So once diagnosed, how did health officials react and snap into, you know, epidemic mode?
So when the health department got a call from the doctor saying that they suspected case of measles with the man's contact information, they tried to reach the man. The man's cell phone was had a corrupted SIM card, so it wasn't working. And they knew that it was in the Orthodox Jewish community. So they had good relations with sort of a liaison, somebody who worked at the health department, but who also volunteered for the emergency medical volunteers, the docs who served this Orthodox Jewish community called Hatzala. And that man, Steve McGraw, contacted his contacts in the community, and together they went and they were able to pinpoint this man's location and find him.
And then did it follow that they had to find every single person that that man had come in contact with?
Yes. The disease detective work for an infectious outbreak is incredibly time intensive, because then the man had to recount where he had been, what hours of the day he was there, and retrace his footsteps. And then the health officials had to go and put out all the information. Anybody who was at this congregation or this Jewish pizza market has to make sure that they were vaccinated, and it ended up with hundreds and hundreds of contacts.
So once they identified patient zero and acted and tracked down other people that he had contacted, were they able to contain the epidemic, or was it just going to be 39 people anyway?
I think that the health officials will tell you that in this outbreak, because they worked so closely and so quickly with the Orthodox community, they were able to get the message out, and they were able to organize 3 vaccination clinics in 1 synagogue in a week, get almost 1,000 people vaccinated, and everybody sort of participated and worked closely together. The Council of Orthodox Rabbis issued this unequivocal statement that said everybody had to be vaccinated, and between the start of the outbreak in March 13th until early April, they have given out more than 2,100 vaccinations. And vaccine refusal or vaccine hesitancy does not appear to be a major factor. One thing that's different about this outbreak is it was mostly in adults.
Lena Sun, thank you very much for this.
You're welcome.
Lena Sun has been covering the measles outbreak for The Washington Post. Coming up, Tracy Morgan is back, and he's starring in a TBS dramedy about re-entry after 15 years in prison.
I'm not here to laugh, okay? I'm here to inspire. I'm here to teach young average kids on the verge of making the same mistake as you did. Come on, man. You don't think I haven't heard this before?
The Last OG, tackling serious issues but still bringing the laughs. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brand. Time for our regular Tuesday TV convo, TV on the radio. We're going to take a break from the 24/7 Game of Thrones frenzy and instead show some love for a somewhat overlooked TBS show called The Last OG.
I got locked up for 15 years! 15 years!
And that's Tracy Morgan in his first regular television role since his serious car accident of a few years ago. Morgan plays a Brooklyn drug dealer who took the fall for a colleague and served 15 years in prison. The show follows him as he tries to pick up his life again on his now very different, very gentrified home turf, and tries to reunite with his baby mama, played by Tiffany Haddish. The Last OG recently started its second season. Melanie McFarland is TV critic for Salon. And hi, Melanie.
Hi there.
And Sonia Soraya is TV critic for Vanity Fair. Good to have you here, Sonia.
Thanks so much.
Melanie, why don't I start with you? You know, when I heard before the first season that the show was going to star Tracy Morgan and Tiffany Haddish, I thought, oh my gosh, if Morgan is back up to speed, then this is really going to be comedy gold. So for people who haven't seen it, give us a sense of the tone. You know, is this an outrageous, laugh-out-loud sitcom, something you'd expect from those talented people?
So keep in mind that the showrunners have changed between the first season and second season. I will say that. I think the first season, to your point, was attempting to find a balance between that kind of, as you say, outrageous comedy and really getting in some meaty social commentary about gentrification, but also about reentry to, you know, to the world, and specifically going back to an urban environment after, you know, Tracy Morgan's character had been incarcerated for 15 years. So it's hard to strike that balance. At least it was in the first season. But in season two, now it's being run by Saladin Patterson. And I think one of the things that he wanted to do was to really say, okay, we've established these characters, and take that and really get into some issues of who these people are as people, as opposed to trading in the popularity of Haddish and Morgan as comics, which I think, you know, last season was very consciously a vehicle, in my opinion, as opposed to, you know, a storytelling platform for the issues at hand.
And the show really gets into some really serious issues, including this issue of gentrification. And it also has such a strong sense of place. Sonia, why don't you tell us, how does it capture Brooklyn and gentrification and this collision of old and new?
It's so specific. I think that that's one of the things that it's really successful with. It films throughout Brooklyn. When I wrote about it, the thing that was sort of funny, which it happened as I was, like, after I'd gotten the assignment, I realized they'd set up a shoot on my block, which I wasn't expecting at all. But I think it sort of speaks to how it is where Brooklyn is, too, I think. It feels like a show that's trying to be in a conversation with the community it's in. And what's interesting is that outside of the production, TBS and Tracy Morgan have made efforts to refurbish. They refurbished a playground at the Marcy Houses, which is where Tracy Morgan actually grew up. So there's interesting investment happening behind the scenes. Within the show itself, there's so much specificity in terms of where they are and what they love about Brooklyn. And then what gets really interesting about the characters is how granular the differences between them are and their experiences throughout the neighborhood, and how different they are based on how much money they have or where they grew up within the borough, or who their friends are, what their race is, of course. And it makes for just some really interesting snapshots, I think, that offer, I don't know, they just offer so much detail that's rich. And I think that bounces off the other characters' stories, too. So you can watch a character go through something like, for example, Alan Maldonado's character, Cousin Bobby, who's sort of, you know, an adorable doofus. The way that he kind of bounces through the world and tries to make things work for him is so markedly different from the way that Shannon, Tiffany Haddish's character, who has learned how to be a successful person in a working world dominated by white people, the way that she asks for money when she needs it and the way that she negotiates is just so markedly different. There's clearly a huge, vast different experience between these two people who are more or less from the same place.
Yeah, all of the relationships are really interesting. And Melanie, tell us about the relationship of Shay and her husband, who's white, Josh. How do they navigate that?
Well, You know, I think actually I wanted to pivot back really quickly to add on to something that Sonia just said, which is one of the things that this show does that I don't see really many, if any, series doing on television is handling these issues of what it means when you are part of a minority to traverse different social and economic classes and what that kind of the psychological and social effects on you. And I think that's something that this show is doing that no other show is doing quite as well. And there are a couple of episodes that speak to that, but also speak to that in terms of the economics of, say, you know, asking for a loan.
You don't qualify for the loan.
Run my credit.
Sure, what's your social?
Oh, yeah, this got a white last name on it.
Oh, you want Jewish.
You want Jewish. I got you. Smickelson.
Being able to secure financing is still very much an issue. But in terms of, you know, Shay and Josh, one thing that I love about this show is that it doesn't do what has classically been done on sitcoms when they're interracial couples, which is either ignore the fact that they're an interracial couple or actually kind of play up these differences as some sort of strange, almost jokey version of opposites attract.
Right, or a jokey anthropological
exactly. And I exercise. Think one of the things, and particularly in the second season, they not only show how they are in this marriage of equals, but they also show how, you know, even though Josh, this is the woman he loves, he knows, you know, her children are his children, you know, he is dad to them and he defends them in the best way, you know, that he knows how, that he still has a lot to learn. There's this great conversation where Josh actually says to Shay, you know, sometimes I step in because other white people are afraid of you. You make them afraid. And that's something that as a Black woman, that's a trope that's really thrown on Black women disproportionately to, you know, to the general like female population of the United States. But she actually says, okay, you know, I'll accept that, but here's what you're not seeing.
So you think all of those things happen for no reason?
May I see your ID?
Sure, but why'd you ask him for my ID? You didn't ask for that young lady's ID that was just here.
I was just doing my job, ma'am.
But do you know her? Oh, my keys.
Dark complexion. Excuse me, is this your car?
Yes. Can you help me get my keys?
Okay, yeah, she's getting a little agitated.
Call the police. Maybe they can get my keys out of here. See, I have plenty of reasons to go off every time.
This is a show where you see the characters, you see the world from their point of view, and you see the way that society reacts to, say, Josh when he's with Shahzad or with his Black family. And the things that he's able to, you know, to kind of smooth their way through the world versus when Trey is in those same situations, you know, with maybe one of his kids or a couple of his kids and Shay, and how the world reacts very differently to him, you know, outside of the fact that he is an ex-convict, the fact that he's a Black man walking with his, with his Black family interacting with this very gentrified Brooklyn, you know, versus Josh, who now looks more like what a typical Brooklyn resident might think that, you know, one of their own looks like.
Well, you're both anticipating my next question, which is whether this is a turning point for television in the sense that the industry might be moving beyond that these kinds of situations and these kind of gateway series like Blackish or Fresh Off the Boat for shows starring people of color, that it's reaching a different place where you can explore the subtleties.
Often shows that are about interracial relationships or about communities, two different groups of people, ethnicities, social classes colliding, tend to make it into a sort of almost vaudevillian, like, aren't these two groups so hilariously different? Ha ha ha. The Last OG feels unique to me because of how much it invests in the way that this community might tell a story about itself. You know, Tracy Morgan, when I interviewed him, he said this is a show starring the community. This isn't a show, you know, set in the community, about the community. This is showcasing. This is starring this community. I think that to me, that's what feels really different, is that it feels like TBS has found that there is an audience that they can serve, and they're looking to see how they can best and most richly do that. And so that feels very specific, and it feels like a real a real close relationship and kind of a service too, which feels a little bit different from like mining something and being and then taking it and showing it to a different audience, a wider audience, and being like, haha, look at how different everything is, if that makes sense.
Melanie, what do you think of that?
I think that anytime that we talk about a turning point, we also have to look and say that there have been many turning points throughout history when it comes to television. In terms of, you know, if we look at the demographics of, you know, who has money to spend and that kind of thing, yes, this stands to be, I think, a turning point in that regard. I think that we still have a long way to go just in terms of what kinds of stories get told and how they get told. We have a long way to go in terms of the kind of honesty and, as you know, speaking to what Sonia said, the reality of how these stories are presented. I agree with Sonia. The fact that The Last OG is so specific, but also doesn't preach, doesn't turn off the audience, really kind of brings the audience into that sense of community and has the audience invested in not just Trey's success, but also understanding Shay, understanding Josh, and this season in particular, understanding things, you know, the challenges that their kids face. That's still pretty unique in television. And if you look at the other shows about gentrification and, you know, the changing social dynamics and demographics of different urban areas, most of them are on premium cable. The ones that are really kind of, you know, being honest about the ramifications, like The Chi in its second season, that's on Showtime. You know, you see a little bit of it in Shameless, also on Showtime. Insecure, that's on HBO. Vita, that's on Stars. Those are all series that really deal with the ramifications of the demographics, both racial and economic, of a neighborhood changing around the people who have been traditionally living there for a really long time. The difference with The Last OG is that they don't make the neighborhood the joke. They actually bring the humor of the situation to the viewer in a way that's really accessible and actually, as Sonia says, honors the community that it's set in.
Similar to Insecure, and I thought of Insecure when I was thinking and watching The Last OG and anticipating this conversation. And also, I said at the beginning of the segment that this show is somewhat overlooked. I mean, here you have these real headliners, Tracy Morgan and Tiffany Haddish, and you have a show that's dealing in these very serious topics, but are issues, but is also really pretty hilariously funny at points. So why do you think it is flying so under the radar, and who is watching? How popular is it?
So actually, when The Last OG's first season premiere, when that series premiere drew 1.8 million viewers, and that it said it marks the biggest cable comedy premiere since 2016.
Wow. Right.
So yeah, but I do think that just in terms of, you know, getting the word out there, I've heard more coverage on, say, Snoop Dogg Presents The Joker Is Wild than I've seen more coverage on that than I've seen on The Last OG. And part of it may be that it's, you know, this comedy that actually is top lined by really well-known comedians, but it might not be on, say, like what's considered by other, you know, critics and, you know, people who write about television to be on like the sexiest channel.
Well, there's so much to watch out there, but this has been really interesting. I want to thank you, Sonia. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
And Melanie, great to talk with you too.
Thanks so much.
Sonia Sarai, TV critic for Vanity Fair. Melanie McFarland is TV critic for Salon. Thanks again to you. Coming up, several Angelenos woke up this morning newly minted Pulitzer Prize winners. We'll meet the composer who won that honor for her opera, The Prism. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. The Pulitzers were announced last night, and that means several Angelenos can now add Pulitzer Prize winner to their bios. Three Los Angeles Times reporters won for their investigative work exposing abuse by a gynecologist at USC. Darren Bell, an LA native, won for editorial cartooning. And composer Ellen Reed won the Pulitzer Prize for music for her debut opera, Prism. Prism is about the psychological trauma of sexual assault. Reed is having a breakout year. She's the first composer to have a world premiere with all four of LA's biggest classical music institutions, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, LA Master Chorale, LA Chamber Orchestra, and LA opera. And composer Ellen Reed joins me now. Hello and congratulations.
Thank you. It's wild.
Yeah. How'd you react when you found out?
Honestly, I found out through friends texting me, and I screamed so much that my neighbor thought that someone had died.
Through texting. That's a very 2019 way to find out you won a Pulitzer. That's wonderful. So tell us, what's the story of Prism, the storyline? How does it unfold over the three acts?
Yeah, so Prism is a story about memory. It's a story about how our brains process trauma, and a story about survival. And so I'm going to talk about it in a non-linear way because that's how we conceived of the piece. So it is a piece that's in three acts, and I'm going to start telling the story in act two. So a mother and a daughter decide to go to a club together, and the daughter's underage. It seems like something really fun. It comes from a place of wanting to show the daughter a good time and the mother really doing the best that she can. And while they're in the club, the mother leaves and the daughter is assaulted. The mother doesn't know how to process this and wants to keep the daughter as far away from anything that could remind her of what happened to her in the club as she possibly can. And so she creates this imaginary world inside their one room home. And you begin the opera in this one room home, and the mythology from this imaginary world kind of infiltrate this first section. And the daughter, as the first scene, as the first act goes on, kind of starts to get more and more curious about what's outside the world. And then as the play unfolds, the daughter has to decide whether or not to stay in the imaginary world that her mother created that's, void of the trauma, but also void of life. And so at the end, for us, we decided that she had to leave and she had to confront the world, even though she was unequipped to, and that felt like a really powerful choice.
So it's very much about surviving sexual abuse and assault. And it sounds like how we kind of remember or rewrite our own memories and our own story about the trauma in order to survive. Why did you want to tackle that subject?
Well, we started working on this project before the Me Too movement. And this is something that happens to so many people. And it's something that a lot of the people on the creative team have personally experienced. And opera is such a collaborative art form that everybody's experience is poured into making the work. And as we kind of kept moving along with the project, it just felt like it was getting more and more relevant with Me Too. And then literally I was finishing orchestrating the piece during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. And so it felt like we went from a time when the piece would have been heard as a piece about a woman, and now it's a story about a piece about people and something that happens to people. And that journey has been as thrilling as anything about the piece. And the reception we've gotten from it is like beyond, beyond.
Let's hear a little bit from one of the compositions in Prism that addresses this idea of healing. This is called Blue. And I believe the mom is trying to comfort and heal her daughter in this scene. What were you trying to convey with that?
In this scene, what's actually happening is that the parts of the daughter that she hasn't brought into this imaginary world are kind of beckoning to her from outside the door. And so the daughter's trying to connect with this mysterious force that is outside the door, and that's the voices of the choir that was sung by the incredible Trinity Wall Street Choir. So during the scene, the mother is actually asleep.
Ah, and musically, what were you conveying? What do those voices convey?
Those voices convey unknown, and I also think that they convey a type of sensuality and pleasure that the daughter hasn't experienced, that she's curious about and trying to welcome into her world. It's a So almost a weird awakening is what I was trying to convey.
So let's hear some more music. And this is called Prism Club Song. And in this scene, the mother leaves the daughter unattended. And this is when the sexual assault happens. Wow, a lot going on there musically and thematically. So what is happening there, and what musical elements were you playing around with to layer and achieve that overwhelming wall of sound effect you were going for?
A huge part of Prism is this choral aspect, and that the chorus is singing as parts of the daughter, kind of as part of her psyche that she's trying to reconnect with. So it felt to me like when I wanted to explore these traumatic events, there's almost this wall of static around all of them. And so for the daughter to be able to remember them clearly, she had to pass through these intense walls of static. And what you hear at the end of that is one of those walls of static where she moves from something that feels really overwhelming to a moment when she's seeing things more clearly. And what feels really overwhelming is this is before the actual assault, which we don't depict on stage. This is kind of build up to the assault. And what you are hearing is the daughter, who's sung by an L.A. native, Anna Schubert, reacting to the presence of this person near her that she doesn't want them there. And she is trying to push them off her.
What I heard was all of the static being those voices that come into your head, that everyone has this idea that it can be, they can be dismissive, and you know, he's just playing, you know, tossing it aside.
Yeah, writing this piece, those voices were really loud in my head too, you know, so it's definitely.
Let's play another clip, and this is from a scene in which towards the end of the opera, the daughter has to make a decision about how she'll go forward with her life. Wow, so what's she deciding there? What does she decide?
She is standing at that moment in front of the door, trying to decide whether or not to open it, and her mother is watching her. And so she is deciding in that moment whether or not to stay in this world or to stay in the imaginary world or to go into the world absolutely unequipped. And it's a really powerful moment between the mother and daughter. And the voices, you can hear it in the strength of the voices and the heroism of the music. And it felt like we had to give that to the audience after sitting through the piece, and we had to give that to the characters and to the daughter after living with what had happened to her.
Well, so what do you want people in the audience to come away with from this, particularly people who haven't experienced sexual assault?
I think of music as a way to connect with lives that aren't our own. And so I'm interested in writing music about a lot of different themes. And in this particular work, I got a lot of messages from people who had seen the work, and they said that they had experienced emotions that they had never had before. And I think to me, the power of music is to bring you closer to leading a life that isn't your own, or to understanding a life that isn't your own.
Well, thank you very much for this, and congratulations again.
Thank you.
Ellen Reed, she's an LA-based composer who won the Pulitzer Prize for her music in the opera Prism. Michelle Alloy is not singing here, but she is here.
You wouldn't want to hear that.
With feedback.
That would be an automatic turnoff.
It's okay. Hit me with the feedback-a-rama.
We didn't ask about opera. We asked our listeners if they thought long-shot candidates should stay out of the 2020 presidential race. Obviously, it's a really crowded field on the Democratic side. Tori on Twitter said, "Let Gravel speak." That appears to be a reference to former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel. He's a Democrat, probably the definition of a long shot candidate, so she seems in.
Well done with the obscure reference.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. I thought it was gravel, which I don't know what that says about me. And on Facebook, John G. Hill said, "It seems like everyone is picking their own plot of discussion."
Good stuff. Thank you for the feedback. Thank you all for comments. And that's it for Press Play today. We'll see you back here tomorrow.